Good morning, everybody. My name is Oliver Ferguson. I know that when we moved in, we're moving from the spring into the summer. I remember Renee sent an email earlier about maybe you could do something that you did before, something that you're really passionate about. And John chapter 4 is something, one of my favorite parts of the Bible. I just always like going back to it. Then afterwards, there's another email saying that we're following the lectionary, but I was really just said, I'm going to stick with John chapter 4. So forgive me for not sticking with the lectionary for this Sunday. About 2 years ago, as a fellowship, we went through the book of John. So some of this might have heard before, but John is just so beautifully written in its simplicity and its focus, unlike Mark, where every other paragraph seemed to say, and then they went here, then they went there, then they went there. John seemed to slow things down. It's a lot more narrative than the other Gospels, a lot more monologues and dialogues. Like Jesus has big speeches and long conversations, a lot of symbolism in there, and a lot of dualism, sort of contrasts, light versus darkness, life versus death, freedom versus slavery, spirit, flesh, and a few more. The other thing that you find in John is these multiple meaning phrases that Jesus comes up with that almost always lead in confusion and misunderstanding, as Jesus is saying one thing, but he's using language and referencing something that's totally different. I don't know if the confusion is intended, like he intends to confuse people, or he wants them to misunderstand him. I don't know, but it happens a lot in the book of John, and John chapter 4 is one of those places. It's about the Samaritan woman or the woman at the well are sort of two common names given to this section where Jesus encounters a woman in the middle of the day while traveling from Jerusalem to Galilee, going through what is not necessarily enemy territory, but sort of territory where there is ethnic tension. So, over the years, I've heard this preached on myself. A lot of the focus is on who the woman is and what the relationship between Jews and Samaritans are. But today, I want to spend a little bit more time just sort of looking and walking through what is it they talked about. So let's see what we have here. And so another side note, it's this particular section, this conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman is the longest recorded dialogue we have with Jesus and anybody else. So he spends a lot of time talking with her, and in terms of the people who recorded the gospel, this was the one that got the most space. And it's one that has this multiple meaning that we can go through. And the thing about this conversation that I really like about it is that it, as it proceeds, there's sort of this upping the ante. So it starts at this place, there's this confusion, and as they kind of start through the confusion, they take it up a notch, and then they take it up a notch, and they take it up a notch, and that's something I really appreciate about it. But I want to step back a little bit and talk about the buildup, and what was going on, and what sort of is the larger context in the book of John of where the story falls. So by this point, very early in the book of John, Jesus gains disciples. And he, his disciples, and some family members go down to Jerusalem for a Passover. So that's where they are. Now, things get kind of rowdy when he gets there. And Jesus is sort of bursts on the scene at this Passover meal, although he was developing a name for himself before that in Galilee, but he goes to Jerusalem. he goes into the temple and he sees trade going on, commerce, throws over tables, scatters money, gets a whip, and he's like chasing people out of the temple. So he makes a scene. This is a grand entrance into Jerusalem. And at some point, the rulers at the time, the Pharisees, or people who were among the ruling class, where do you get the right to do this? Then he brings in one of his multiple meaning statements. If you break this temple down, I'll build it back in 3 days. They didn't understand it. The writer of John explains that he was talking about this body. Now, it doesn't record that he did miracles like he healed this person or raised this person from the dead, but from the sense you get from reading it is that he did do miracles. And he considers reference in John chapter 2. While in Jerusalem, many people believed because they saw the miraculous signs he did. So he was working miracles. He chased people out of the temple. He's really making a name for himself. A man called Nicodemus, one of the leaders there, comes to him late at night and says, look, nobody works miracles unless they're from God. And he and Jesus have this quiet conversation late at night. Then the story transitions into talking about how Jesus is surpassing John the Baptist. His disciples are baptizing more people than John the Baptist is. And John himself, when confronted with this reality, says, I must decrease, he must increase as I decrease. So John acknowledges and sort of passes the torch from one sort of charismatic gatherer of disciples to another, someone who is challenging the order of the day. And we learn after he has this encounter with a Samaritan woman later in John chapter 4, that when he gets to Galilee, his reputation precedes him. So people who were from Galilee were in Jerusalem, or at least heard about what happened in Jerusalem, and there's a lot of excitement about an expectation for his arrival. So when he came to Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him because they had seen all the things he had done in Jerusalem. So this is sort of the setting. He bursts on the scene. He is making a name for himself. He's gaining followers. He's beginning to disrupt the order. Passover is over. He and his disciples are on their way back to Galilee, and they have to go through Samaria. So it's the middle of the day, this one snapshot. And I don't think anybody in Samaria knows who he is. So here is Jesus becoming a star, but he is in this context where they don't know who he is. Throughout the dialogue and from what we read from the story, it doesn't tell us that he worked or performed any miracles while he was in Samaria. And he's talking to Nicodemus, who's a prominent person. I mean, even if it's late at night, if somebody really important called you, you would feel some sense of your own importance as well. Here he is having a discussion, a conversation with someone who's not very prominent. So it's this very strange, the trajectory of Jesus' life and ministry, his reputation is going this way, and here is this little conversation that happens where none of that matters in the moment. So talking to the woman was clearly countercultural for a number of reasons, but let's look at the beginning of their conversation. He gets to this location. There's a well. He's very thirsty. His disciples leave him to get some food. And this woman comes up and he asks her for, could I have some water, please? The Samaritan woman asks, why do you, a Jewish man, ask for something to drink from me, a Samaritan woman? Jews and Samaritans didn't associate with each other. Jesus responded, if you recognize the gift, God's gift, and who is saying to you, give me some water to drink, you would be asking him, and he would give you living water. The woman said to him, "Sir, you don't have a bucket, and the well is deep. Where would you get this living water? You aren't greater than our father Jacob, are you? He gave us this well to us, and he drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." Jesus answered, "Everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks from the water that I will give will never be thirsty again. The water that I give will become in those who drink it a spring of water that bubbles up into eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I will never be thirsty and will never need to come and draw." So here's clearly one of these double meaning conversations where he really was thirsty. It was the middle of the day. But he pivots into this deeper spiritual meaning. And he introduces some deeper spiritual truth. So as we know, he's crossing many boundaries here, the physical boundary of being in Samaria as a Jewish person, and also speaking with a woman who, him being a rabbi or considered a leader, again, he's building his reputation as a famous leader, wouldn't necessarily engage with women that much. But in the context of their conversation, the difference, the ethnic difference between Jew and Samaritan is the most relevant. And that's what she brings up, and that's what a little of the early tension is between them. The woman has this, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, who are you, young fellow? Pump your brakes." So he talks about living water, which, again, she's thinking in literal meaning, which means that there's a river or a stream where the water is moving somewhere. And he's suggesting that, oh, I can find better source of water than Jacob did. And so she is pumping the brakes, like, "No, fella, are you greater than our father Jacob with your living water?" But then he then ups the ante by suggesting that everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but the water I talk about will spring out of you, not something that's springing from the ground. This will be a better source. Though she's thinking about water, Jesus is perhaps thinking of Jeremiah 17 as one of the places where the Bible talks about water and the important using that imagery as a symbol of salvation. And I'll just read some parts here for you. Jeremiah 17. "You will lose the inheritance that I gave you. I will make you slaves to your enemies in a land you don't know. For my anger blazes like a fire that won't go out, the Lord proclaims. Cursed are those who trust in mere humans, who depend on human strength and turn their hearts from the Lord. They will be like a desert shrub that doesn't know when relief comes. They will live in the parched places of the wilderness, in a barren land where no one survives. Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will suffer disgrace. Those who turn away from you in the land will be written off, for they have abandoned the Lord, the fountain of living water. Heal me, Lord, and I'll be healed. Save me, and I'll be saved. For you are my heart's desire." So the conversation, Jesus introducing this deeper meaning, suggesting that the water that is truly lacking is that deep connection with God himself as a source of life. And that maybe the Samaritans have fallen away, moved away from that. Conversation moves on. He gets very curious. So Jesus said to her, "Go get your husband and come back here. Come back here." The woman replied, I don't have a husband. "You are right to say I don't have a husband," Jesus answered. You've had five husbands, and the man you are with now isn't your husband. You've spoken the truth. So we've shifted from talking about water to talking about husband. So there are a couple of things about this request from Jesus. His request could be looked at a couple of different ways. Firstly, it could be something to put her at ease. Now, I know usually she is sort of the one that people are supposed to be worried about, but she is a single woman at a well. If there's this guy, she might be the one who needs to be put at ease. Maybe they're in her mind, and one of the structures that we see throughout the Old Testament is men and women meeting at wells, water sources, that moves on to getting married. We see this with Moses and Rebecca. Isaac's servant found his son a wife at a well. And so she is in a slightly vulnerable position. And so by introducing the situation of, hey, get your husband, this might be something that could be putting her at ease. Another thing that you find is a motif of hospitality to a divine source. So we have angels coming to Abraham, and you have to treat them as these divine visitors. You have this sort of epiphany moment. And by asking her to bring the husband, he is essentially lending a hand of hospitality, or offering her the opportunity to be hospitable to him. And so we see Jesus crossing the boundary physically, crossing the boundary by speaking with her, and crossing the ethnic boundaries, and crossing it all the way to hospitality, to the point where, as we saw earlier, she is the one now asking him, would you give me something to drink, as the tables switch. It's possible that this reference to her husband, this dialogue about her husband, is talking about a situation that she is in. Now, something to bear in mind, that the Deuteronomical laws really makes it fairly easy for a man to divorce a woman. And as time went on, men had flimsier and flimsier excuses. And if you look at Deuteronomy 24, all a man would have to do is write her a note and send her out of the house. So it's like, you're dismissed. And many scholars believe that her issue might be that she was unable to have children. And she might have been in a situation where, because she's unable to have children, the men are displeased and dissatisfied in the marriage. And given the power that they have, they could simply write her a note, send her away. This might have happened 5 times. The person she's living with now might not be her husband. But it doesn't mean that she is in a romantic or sexual relationship. It could also mean that it could be a relative of one of the former husbands. Maybe she's a widow at some point in that 5. Or someone who has some sort of power in her life to help to take care of her, as women didn't have full independence in that context. And so the man she's with is likely a caregiver of some sort. And I think about the fact that she's pulling water at the middle of the day as opposed to the cool of the afternoon when everybody else does. This could be either her isolation, or it could be a sense that maybe she's in an abusive situation where she's being asked to do things out of order. Speculative, but just want to say that these are some possible reasons why she's there and why this conversation is important. And by Jesus bringing this up, it wasn't a gotcha moment. It was a moment of empathy. And her response, she really resonates with that. And so it suggests that when we see her responding so well to him bringing this up, I think he strikes a chord with her and they go deeper. So again, Jesus, she is engaging with Jesus with this conversation about marriage and her marital status, but Jesus might be going even deeper. Like in, he might be referencing Psalm 27, where it says, God who saves me, don't neglect me. Don't leave me all alone. Even if my father and mother left me alone, the Lord would take me in. Lord, teach me your way. But I have sure faith that I will experience the Lord's goodness in the land of the living. This would be a powerful and moving sentiment for woman in her circumstance. Someone who has been in vulnerable places throughout her life and is probably in a vulnerable place right now. And this affirmation from him would have been a powerful message to her. And so the conversation moves on to another topic. As she feels this empathy and love from him, she brings it to worship. So recognizing that Jesus is a prophet or someone who is has deep spiritual knowledge, the woman asks a question about places of worship. She asks, our ancestors worshipped in this mountain where they are standing, but you and your people say that it is necessary to worship in Jerusalem. A couple of things. One, it reveals that she's a pretty well-informed person and is very aware of religion and spiritual things. And this is not a very loose question as someone who isn't conscious and aware would ask. And she's aware of the deep spiritual divide between Samaritans and Jews. But it suggests that she's also genuinely interested in finding and worshiping God. And so not only does she lack maybe the spousal relationship that she desires, but Jesus is digging into the desire for her to worship God and to connect with God. And Jesus' response is interesting because, again, let's go back to the larger context. He was just in Jerusalem. So as she talks about, should we worship here to where we're standing, or should we worship in Jerusalem? He was just in Jerusalem a couple days ago. What was he doing in Jerusalem? Kicking over tables and whipping people out of the temple. And so there was no worship going on in Jerusalem at the time. And there was no worship happening at that mountain that they were standing at the time. And so I think about the times in some of the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and John, and Luke, where Jesus takes the pain of telling people, don't say who I am, or don't, keep quiet. He takes this opportunity to have this deeper conversation about worship. He said, believe me, woman, the time is coming when you and your people will worship the Father, neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You and your people worship what you don't know. We worship what we know because salvation is from the Jews. But the time is coming and is here when true worshipers will worship in spirit and in truth. God is spirit, and it is necessary to worship God in spirit and truth. Having gotten that empathy about her place and that affirmation of her personhood, having gotten her concern and worship and for worship and true connection with God responded to, she ups the ante even more and introduces the Messiah. And she says, I know that the Messiah is coming, the one who is called the Christ. When he comes, he will teach us everything. And Jesus says to her, I am the one who speaks with you. So, as Renee was saying earlier, that the temple is a place to meet Jesus, and we sort of have this place as our sacred space to meet Jesus. But Jesus is saying to us that we are not locked into this place. And as he, in his experience at the time, would have been coming from Jerusalem where there was no worship to another so-called holy mountain where there's no worship, he references and digs to truth and the Holy Spirit. So I invite you, as we go to the table for communion, and to more worship, let's have that true connection. Jesus at this time went to Jerusalem and did not find people who were waiting for or looking for the Messiah. But here in this, on the way, here in this place where nobody knew where he was, where he wasn't working any miracles, he wasn't giving any big speeches, here he found someone looking for the Messiah. The Messiah is seeking after us. And as we go through our day-to-day lives, there are many opportunities for us to have these double-meaning conversations. As we go through our own frustrations, we can tap into that desire to be with God, that there is deeper meaning for our lives. There is deeper meaning for the things that happen to us. So the Messiah is here. Jesus is here. And we can worship him in spirit and in truth. Amen.